we are able to deduce certain facts that God is. Creation appeals to man's reason. Secondly, conscience. Okay, man's inner nature, his inner being. It appeals to man's feeling. Thirdly, experience, the history of Jesus Christ. They go together. Scripture and pure revelation, they match. And what God has done is He has revealed Himself so that no matter how a person is oriented toward learning, they can find a channel to come to God through that. There's a real interesting field in psychology today that studying the ways different people learn. Some people learn through seeing. And so when they say something, they'll say, "Oh, I see." Other people are prone to learn simply through reasoning, through deduction, and they'll say, "Oh, I understand that." And other people are very emotional-oriented, and they'll say, "Well, I feel that's true." And certain teachers, certain churches, certain books, certain approaches will appeal to different people on the basis of how they learn. It's interesting that God has built this into not only man's nature, but also into the way that God has revealed Himself to man. So that no matter how you are oriented to trying to approach knowledge, everybody has an avenue through which they can draw near to God, find truth, find reality. So man learns, God reveals, because He wants to put what man learns together with what He wants man to understand. So we expect men to ask questions in those areas if they have trouble seeing God. And the first area in which they would ask questions is the area of creation. Does creation really reveal God? And modern man has said, no, it doesn't. It reveals, in fact, the dearth of God, a void. There is no necessity for God. Because if you can have the world by the general theory of evolution, you don't need God. Everybody still with me? Any questions? So we want to study the general theory of evolution to see if, in fact, it does away with the necessity of God. Now, I don't expect you all to understand all of the little facts I throw out. I don't expect you to all be able to necessarily turn around and use them. What I do want you to do is have a sense of confidence that some people, people much smarter than I am, who are experts in the field, have studied this area, and they are not naive about what Scripture teaches. It's not a matter of closing your eyes and saying, well, the Bible says God created, therefore you avoid anything that suggests otherwise. Otherwise, you'll destroy the Bible. That's not true. You don't have to be afraid of that. I have given these lectures in schools like the University of California at Berkeley. I have had scientists from the University of Oklahoma, Southern Methodist University, University of Texas, Texas A&M, all over the place. Look at this data. I have never had one scientist dispute this material. In fact, I have seen several men come to know the Lord through this. Many others say, that may be true, but I still don't believe it. But no one has ever disputed the fact that, yes, there is serious doubt to the theory of evolution. Serious doubt. And like G.A. Kirkut said, as I quoted today, it's a matter of faith on the part of the biologist. And he can choose whatever method happens to suit him best. But you got to have some answer. The ultimate reality. If you don't want God, you choose something else. So I want you to have a sense of confidence that you can read Science Magazine, you can read National Geographic, you can read those texts and take apart what they are saying, you know, think it through and find out what really is solid evidence and what really is merely theory. You'll be able to discern between those and then use the information to counter the general theory of evolution. The general theory of evolution has three primary elements. They are chance, progress, time. All life originated by chance, progressed from simple to complex over millions and billions of years, over eons. And this morning we dealt with the area of chance. Does science actually show the probability of the universe originating by chance, at least within the laws that there are today? And the answer was absolutely not. The science show the probability of life having originated by chance, at least according to the theories and laws that are available today? And the answer was no. It's highly improbable. It takes a great degree of faith. And the third area was, does science show the probability of life progressing by chance? And the answer was no. It's highly improbable. In fact, the probabilities would demand so much time that no one even theorizes that the universe itself is old enough to have accommodated that kind of gradual progression by mutation and natural selection. Okay, that's all theory that we were dealing with. And then the evolutionist raises the question, but what about the evidence for evolution? What about the fossil record, the geological timetable, prehistoric men or ape men? What about those? Aren't those evidences, aren't those proofs that evolution actually has taken place? So we come to the area of progress. Is there evidence for evolutionary progress? And in this hour, we're going to talk about evolutionary progress, the evidence, specifically through the geological timetable, prehistoric men, and if we have time, we may go into a little bit more. With me? Any questions? All right, let's look, first of all, at the geological timetable. Here's the way the theory goes. Now, I'm quoting from a very fundamentalist Christian writing called the Encyclopedia Britannica. You recognize that's a joke. Okay, the Encyclopedia Britannica is not fundamentalist. Okay. The Encyclopedia Britannica says this, that since evolution is a fact, the geological timetable shows the progress in fossil development, and we are able to date the fossils by the rocks that they occur in, and in turn, we are able to date the rocks by the fossils that they contain. Since evolution is a fact, we can date rocks by fossils and fossils by rocks. It goes on to say that that may be circular reasoning, but since evolution is a fact, it's okay. What in the world are they talking about? Okay, that's the geological timetable. You, I'm sure, have seen something like that. The geological timetable is based on a theory that you can reconstruct the order of evolutionary development by putting fossils in order from simple to complex and then dating the rocks in which they occur. Then, since the simplest fossils are found in the oldest rocks, you can know how old the simplest fossils are because they're found in the oldest rocks. So here's the geological columns on this side, here is the fossil record on this side, and here are the dates going up the middle. Anybody see any problem with anything that I've said so far? Any logical problem, reasonable problem? Well, that is a problem, but there's a more fundamental problem with what I have put out. Exactly. Let's put it in other terms. There's this watchmaker in Switzerland who goes to work every morning, and on his way to work, he stops by this little jeweler's window and he sets his watch by the clock in the jeweler's window. Then he goes to his watchmaking factory, and every day at noon, he looks at his watch and he blows the town whistle. His factory happens to have the town whistle. And every day at noon, when that town whistle blows, the man who owns that little jewelry shop goes out to the front window and he sets his watch, his clock. Following? So the watchmaker sets his watch by the jeweler's watch, and the jeweler sets his clock by when the whistle goes off. it's circular reasoning. They are both absolutely dependent upon each other. And if one of them is wrong, the other one's wrong. If either one of them is wrong, the other one is wrong. That's exactly the way the geological timetable works. You date the rocks by the fossils because simplest fossils are older. Then you turn around and you date the fossils by the rocks because simple fossils are found in old rocks. Now, how do you know simple fossils are older? Well, according to the general theory of evolution, how do you know that? Exactly, because you believe in evolution. If you don't believe in evolution, then simple fossils may not be older because there are very simple organisms still around in the face of the earth. It's not that all simple organisms have disappeared. Now, it is true that over 98% of all living species are now extinct. Okay? But that doesn't mean that all simple organisms have disappeared, and therefore we only have complex organisms left. There are several problems with this besides the philosophical problem of the circular reasoning. Another problem is this. Now, this one is important. There is nowhere on the face of the earth that the geological column is found in order. Let me say it again. There is nowhere on the face of the earth that the geological column is found in order. That is a theory. That is the way the geological column would appear if, in fact, it did appear, if, in fact, evolution were a fact, if, in fact, fossils were found in order. But it doesn't occur that way. Carl Dunbar, in his book Historical Geology, says, fossils make it possible to recognize the rocks, to correlate events, to work out the history of the Earth as a whole. Goes on to say that unfortunately you can find any geological layer on top of any other geological layer at different places on the earth. The geological column is not found in order. Second problem. Fossils are not found in order from simple to complex. In fact, they're found quite mixed up heterogeneously. For instance, this is the era when coal and oil deposits were theoretically laid down. Human footprints have been found in fossilized coal. Now, humans weren't supposed to have come into existence until something around, now they would say, from 2 to 4 million years ago, but up there in that era. How in the world can you have human footprints fossilized in coal if the coal was fossilized 100 million years ago? It's impossible. This sexy little creature there is a trilobite. You would have loved them if you had only known them. There are lake beds of fossilized trilobites. They were supposed to have died out in the range of 400 million years ago. Yet there are fossilized footprints in trilobites. That's theoretically impossible if they really did die out and were fossilized that long ago. Let's get up to something more common. That's a dinosaur, the sponsor of a famous television program, and now a female golf tournament, dinosaur. The dinosaur was supposed to have died out approximately 130 million years ago. And yet there are cave paintings of dinosaurs. How do you think that happened? Can you picture a touring dinosaur who goes around and paints pictures of baby dinosaurs so that they can decorate their walls with their kids' pictures? There are human footprints fossilized right along with, on top of, dinosaur footprints. And if the human being didn't come into existence until a couple of million years ago and the dinosaur died out 130 million years ago, it is impossible that they could have existed right alongside of each other. there may be the description of a dinosaur in the book of Job. That's possible. It's called the Leviathan. But it's interesting how, if you just forget that it may be a crocodile, picture what Job is describing there. It's amazing how close that thing looks to our idea of a dinosaur. And one other thing. What does a dragon look like? Have any of you seen one? Even in drawings? What do dragons look like? What real creature in history does a dragon resemble? Except it's bigger than an alligator, because an alligator is low and flat, and dragons lived on the ground. It's very, very much like a dinosaur. Is the dragon really a totally mythological being? Or is it possible that the dragon is, in man's memory, actually a dinosaur? Now, let me show you some slides related to this so that you won't think I'm completely crazy. Oops, partly crazy is okay. Not completely crazy. Here in Texas, where you can find almost everything, at the Paluxy River in Glen Rose Canyon, there is a famous, prehistorical area. Okay, let me see if I can get out of your way. I can't get out of your way. Can we see better with the lights on? Why not? Okay, thanks. Let me sit here for just a second. Can you all hear me with my back to you? Can you? Am I blocking anybody? Yes? Okay, we took Charlie Brown and Snoopy just so that we would have witnesses, because at the mouth of two or three witnesses, everything is to be confirmed. That's not a very good print, but that's a brontosaurus footprint. Snoopy found this one. You can see that very clearly. See it over there to the left of the screen? Did anybody not see it? Okay. Then there's that one. You can see that they are on different levels. That gives you an idea of how big they were. Of course, there was some weathering, perhaps, that had taken place and increased it. But some of the best ones were found in the water. Now, that is not mud. That's rock. And the Paluxy River has gradually eroded layer after layer. And then for a while, it will expose prints like this. And then eventually, the water will come along and it will erode those, and it will cut off to a layer that's even below that. There's a little different kind. That's called a three-toed dinosaur. There you can see, you know, obviously a trail. And that's not mud again, that's solid rock. And it's either a dinosaur or a terribly big chicken made those prints. Now, there are also prints like these. It appears to be a humanoid or human-like print. According to the geological timetable, there was nothing that lived alongside of the dinosaur that was even similar to a human being, that walked upright, like a bear or anything like that. Of course, a bear doesn't have prints like that. But according to the theory, nothing lived like that at the time of the dinosaur. Got a nose full there. That one's pretty clear. There were some geologists that sandbagged the river, and then they began following a trail of the human prints from the river back into that area. Okay, there is a trail of the brontosaurus prints. And right there at the top of that is where one of the human-type prints actually contacted the brontosaurus print. Does anyone not see that? Where they're actually touching the top print going to the left, right to left, is part of that human-like trail, and the other print is the brontosaurus print. Now, that's absolutely impossible unless they were alive at the same time. That's the whole point of that. We'll come back to this in a minute. So what's the point of that? The point is that that doesn't prove anything in terms of evolution, because that column, that system, is itself a theory based on the general theory of evolution. And if the general theory of evolution is not true, then the geological timetable, the geological columns, don't prove a thing at all. It's very impressive, but it doesn't prove anything. Any questions on that before I go on to specifically prehistoric men? Nope. All right. Let's talk about prehistoric men. I wish we could talk about prehistoric women, but they have not been found yet. Only prehistoric men. Prehistoric men, the outer appearance of prehistoric men depend upon the artist's conception, the artist who is drawing them. As you know, skin and hair are not fossilized. So whenever you see the drawing of a so-called ape man with hair and skin intact, that is purely, purely based on the imagination of the artist. Here are two different artist conceptions based on exactly the same skull. And you see how one of them appears to be relatively modern, sort of like a philosopher, and the other looks more like an Aggie. I won't ask you which one is which. The point is, you can make them look pretty much like you want to make them look. Okay? There's nothing objective about the outer appearance of them. What about charts like this? Okay? Doesn't that prove that there is evolutionary advance within the realm of the humanoid, from ape to man? Have you all seen charts like this somewhere, sometime? You ever read the fine print? And the funny thing is, okay, this is straight out of Time Life series on prehistoric men. Early Man is the name of the book. The funny thing is that the print under those pictures tells you that there is no evolutionary trail in this chart. And yet they draw it as if there is an evolutionary trail. For instance, let me read to you what it says under Australopithecus robustus. The Australopithecine are supposed to have been between the Homo erectus and the ape. If you read National Geographic, you read Richard Leakey's discoveries, National Geographic is the one that has publicized the Australopithecine, made them almost as great a star as Elizabeth Taylor. Let me read you what the chart says. Australopithecus robustus was a larger, burlier Australopithecine with heavy jaws and big grinding teeth that suggest he was perhaps largely vegetarian. Anything wrong so far? No problems yet. Okay. Though he stood erect and had hominid features, he represents an evolutionary dead end in man's ancestry. Any problem with that? What's the problem? I'm sorry? Yeah, if it's a dead end, it doesn't go any farther. Right? A trail that has a dead end stops. Then you got to go back and start over. So what you have to do is you have to take the Australopithecine out of the chart, because they are dead ends. And all anthropologists recognize that today, that there is no connection between the Australopithecine and the Homo sapien today. You can't include them in the chart. Ramapithecus, supposed to be one of the most complex of the apes, the earliest man-like primate. Now, those are prejudiced words, man-like primate. You can go to the Houston Zoo and you can see some man-like primates. What make them man-like? Well, they have ugly hair on the top and on their face, and they have long arms, and they have appendages, and they have legs, and they walk around on their hind legs. That makes them man-like. Okay? And if that's what you call man-like, fine. They are man-like primates. Ramapithecus is now thought by some experts to be the oldest of man's ancestors in a direct line. This hominid status is predicated upon a few teeth, some fragments of jaw, and a palate unmistakably human in shape. What's it put together from? A few teeth, fragments of jaw, and a palate. Let me read you a comment from David Pilbeam, who is one of the most up-to-date anthropologists, definitely an evolutionist, definitely, as far as I know, not related to Christianity at all. Let me read you what he says about teeth. He says, we need to totally reinterpret fossil evidence for the so-called ape men. First problem was too much attention was being paid to the fossil record as a source of information. The fossil record doesn't give us the information. Secondly, the fossil record, until recently, is fragmentary and poorly dated. It consists entirely of teeth and small pieces of jaw, which are parts of the body that seldom carry information on questions of taxonomy. For example, the equivalent parts of the body in living mammals are generally not of much help in sorting individuals into species or clustering species into higher taxonomic groups. And the reason they discovered that was because some wise guys took a bunch of anthropologists and they tested them. They gave them teeth, and they asked them to reconstruct the individuals that the teeth came from. And they got all sorts of drawings. They got dogs and alligators and monkeys, and some were dated millions of years old and some very modern. And they knew where every one of those teeth came from. They were from modern pigs. And all it proved was, you know, to these men in their own category, that you can't take teeth and reconstruct individuals. It's just theoretical. It doesn't work that way. And furthermore, you never know whether the teeth or the jaw came from a normal being or whether it came from an abnormal being in that group. What you finally wind up with on this chart is you take out all of the things for which there is no evidence or which are dead ends, and you wind up with two definite trails. You wind up with apes on one end, and you wind up with men on the other end. That's pretty good because we still have those. What about all of the ape men that have been discovered? There's a pretty good trail of them right there. Those are the major ones today. Let's see. Let me take this. What I want to do is give you a little bit of the history of the findings of these. And all of this history comes from the men who found them, the non-Christians, the evolutionists, so that you'll see how this works. Let me put a line down the middle there. I'm going to go over this very quickly. You stop me if you want to ask anything specific. On one side, we have the Australopithecine. Now remember, for one thing, we don't have complete skulls. Some of these are made up. They are projected on the basis of fragments. But the drawings are purely artist imaginations. There's nothing factual in that. The Australopithecine is projected primarily on the basis of a small skull that was 494 cc's. That was its brain capacity, 494 cc's, at 6 years of age. And it was extrapolated that as an adult it would be the size of about 550 cc's. Now, how many of you know how large the brain of an ape is? Anybody? Now, any of you have pet apes? No. An ape is 600 cc's, approximately. How large is the normal human being today? Anybody want to guess? Okay, about 1,300 cc's. That's normal human. Okay. The Tongs baby is what it was called. It was found amongst a lot of fossils and tools. It was theorized on the basis purely of cranial configuration that it must have stood upright and therefore must have been pre-man. Today that has been thrown out. At least no one that I know of accepts Australopithecine today as being pre-human. What about Pithecanthropus erectus? You know, every man's favorite. What about those? Now, those are related to two. There is the Java man and the Peking man. You heard of those? Java man, Peking man. Again, cranial capacity was in the range of about 550 cc's. Now, the Peking man is interesting in this because there are drawings that are left of the Peking man that show them up to approximately 800 cc's. But only drawings. There are absolutely no fragments of the Peking man left. What happened is that the anthropologist who discovered the Peking man, his name is Hugo Black, discovered lots of skulls in a cave near Peking, China. And one of the interesting features of all of those skulls was they had a little hole drilled in the back of the skull, just big enough to put a couple of straws and drink out the contents if you wanted to. They theorized that these were something like a macaque, and then Black figured out, no, they are probably prehistoric men. And one day, some of the Chinese workers came running back excitedly into camp because they had just found somewhere between 8 and 10 complete skulls and skeletons. And they were of modern Chinese. The problem was they were found under the layers where the so-called Peking men were found. What's the problem with that? Yeah, they would have been older, or else the contents of the cave somehow got totally turned around. That night, he committed suicide in the middle of the finds. Within a couple of months, all of the original Peking men disappeared. They have never been seen since. And all we have left are doctored drawings of some of those original finds. And there were three anthropologists, independent anthropologists, who saw the original findings, who made drawings of them. And all of their drawings disagree with the doctored drawings that were left from them. And so today that is considered to be one of the frauds in anthropology. The Java man, which is very, very much like the Peking man, is very similar. It showed up in the World's Fair in the early part of this century. It was discovered by a man named Dubois. And there were no complete skulls. There was only the calotte, which is the top part that covers your brain to keep your brain from sloshing out. And then there was a femur. Okay, a femur is a part of the leg. If you hit yourself real hard on the thigh, you will feel it. The femur was of a creature that stood upright. The calotte had a little ridge that is characteristic of an ape. So it looked like, if the two were together, that it was the skull of an ape and the femur of an ape that walked upright. What Dubois did not say was that he found them 50 yards apart. They were not found together. What he did not say also was that at the place where he found the femur, he had found complete skeletons and skulls of what are called the Wajak man, who have cranial capacities of 1,400 to 1,500 cc's, larger than modern man. And before he died, he virtually pulled out these other findings from beneath his bed and said, look, here is what I have found. You have bought it, and I have fooled you. I have kept up this ruse for 28 years, and the scientific world had bought it, and it was a fraud. If you read the introduction to The Origin of Species today by Darwin, the introduction to that is by W.R. Thompson, and he calls this an evident case of fraud. The Peking man, the Java man, are both not real prehistoric men. They are the projections of somebody's inner psyche trying to find something to worship. Now, I drew a line there because on the left side of that line, we have things that are definitely ape in size of their cranium. On the other side, we have things that are definitely man-like in size of the cranium. Neanderthal man had a cranial capacity of about 1,500 cc's. Neanderthal was larger in brain size than we are today. The question is, was Neanderthal a prehistoric man, or was Neanderthal an ape man? And there's a big difference. Understand the difference? Prehistoric means before written history. Ape means part ape, part human. Around 1938 on Mount Carmel in Israel, there was discovered a cave, and inside the cave there was a little burial ground. And in the graves, there was an adult male Neanderthal and an adult female Cro-Magnon, or Cro-Magnon. Now, the Cro-Magnon was supposed to have come into prominence about 10,000 years ago, and Neanderthal was supposed to have died out somewhere between 250,000, and some would bring it down as far as 100,000 years ago. Okay? But they were supposed to be different species living at different times. And yet here, buried on the same level, was an adult male of one, an adult female of the other, and there were six small skeletons buried in between them that had characteristics of both. Now, you all know the facts of life. What does it appear? You got a mama and a papa and all of their puppies, or kids, whatever they called them in those days. How could you have that? Well, either they lived alongside of each other, or else you have a 100,000-year-old man robbing the cradle. And no one suggests that. So probably they are simply different branches of or different races of human beings. The only question is, how long ago did they live? You will hear dates by carbon-14 dating that will go back from 65,000 to 500,000 years. You will hear dates from potassium-argon going back as far as 10 million years. You will hear dates from U-235 going back several million years. The founder of carbon-14 says it will not work beyond 5,000 BC. Therefore, they do not give dates beyond 5,000 BC with carbon-14 dating. Anything beyond that is pure speculation. Potassium argon has been tested from known lava flows. One particular sample was dated from 100,000 years to 2.4 million years. The lava flow was in 1898. We know precisely how old the specimen was, but the date was just wild in comparison to that. Uranium-235 depends upon what the original specimen had in its relationship between lead and uranium. And nobody knows that. You just take a guess. And however old you theorize it is, that's how much lead you assume was in the original specimen. That's how you get your U-235 date. But all of those datings are circular. They are all circular in their methodology. And those dating methods do not work unless you assume the geological timetable so that you know how old certain rocks are, so that you'll know how old the fossils are, so that you can find out how old the specimen is, so that you'll know what date the U-235 or the potassium argon or the carbon-14 dating method ought to give. Have I lost you in that? You're following. We're getting back to the circular reasoning again. But when it comes to this area of prehistoric men, there are definitely prehistoric men. That does not mean they were ape men. I want to show you one more little sample from my slides here. This is from the Smithsonian Institution, which is not exactly a Christian college. Here is a display of how Zinjanthropus man may have looked. On the left is the reconstructed skeleton. You see that little ridge above his head? Okay, that's called a cranial crest. That is typical of apes. And on the right is the artist's imagination of what he would have looked like. Now, this was found by L.S.B. Leakey, Richard Leakey's father. And when he wrote up the findings, he said, let me go back. No, you can't see there. See the pictures in the bottom left-hand side? That picture on the far left is the skeleton found in its original position. Leakey said that when they first saw it, they knew they had discovered what they had been looking for all of their lives. That was before they had any idea what it was, before they had been able to put the skeleton together, before they had any idea of how old it was. He just knew it was what they had been looking for all of their lives, which tells you there's a little emotion that goes into the finding of these things. On the right, there is a human brain, 1,380 cc's. Isn't it pretty? In the middle is a typical gorilla brain, 600 cc's. On the far left is the brain of Zinjanthropus, 575 cc's. Zinjanthropus is more like the brain of an ape or the brain of a man? Brain of an ape. That's not hard to see. And then under the drawing there, it says an ape man ? With muscles and other soft parts added to the reconstructed skull. All right, the skull has been reconstructed. Look at the skull on the left. You see the shiny parts? That is man's idea of what must have fit in there. Okay, that's not part of the original skull. Now, this is the only one of its kind, and how they theorized what must have fit in there is hard to imagine. But anyway, it was, over 400 fragments, and it took them a year and a half to put together. And then they still had to reconstruct it. Okay, with muscles and other soft parts added to the reconstructed skull, Zinjanthropus resembles an ape man. Color is arbitrary. Hair has been omitted. And I have a friend who is an artist who took that same skull and put the hair on it. You know what it looks like? It looks exactly like a modern ape. When I saw that, I really got emotional at the time, because it's right down where all of the kids who come through the Smithsonian Institution can see it at exactly their eye level, and it looks like here is a living representation of evolution, the cross between an ape and a man. And it really breaks my heart to see that being presented as if it is fact instead of being presented as if it's theory. It seems like it is unethical to do something like that. Why not be honest about it? Because the general theory of evolution is the accepted myth or legend of our time. Just as much as legends have pervaded cultures in time past, like the Roman legends of the multiplicity of God, the general theory of evolution is a myth of our time that has permeated society, and you are considered to be insane if you don't recognize it. Now, fortunately, there are many scientists who are not Christians who are beginning to get away from it. But I want you to be aware that there are holes in this evidence, and you don't have to be afraid to study it. And if somebody says to you sometime, look, hasn't evolution disproven the Bible? Simply ask them how. How do you think evolution has disproven the Bible? And what they will come up with is, God didn't create because scientists have found out how it happened without God. And then just let them explain it to you step by step, and eventually they will run into a dead end, and you'll be able to move in with some evidence and say, well, let's see if that's really what the evidence shows. Do you have any questions? Yes, sir.
Might be like that type of death.
if there is anything, okay, and that's the big if, third class condition, it could very well be some large fish. In 1957, a fish was caught off the shore of Newfoundland that was supposed to have been extinct for over 2 million years. Obviously, it wasn't extinct, and it wasn't 2 million years old. Now, it's very possible that that could be something there, if there is anything there at all. Yes, sir?
Is it still accepted as scientific theory in science, or has it been blown apart so bad that it's not even considered theory?
I think it is still accepted as scientific theory because there is, for a scientist, no alternative right now but the supernatural. And since they say you can't have the supernatural, they will accept this theory until something better comes along. You know, as you know, serious scientists don't even worry about this because it doesn't fit into their day-by-day routine. It's really only in the philosophy of science or in high school biology that it's made dominant today. Once you get into graduate school, it's totally irrelevant whether it happened at all. Let me read you a quote by G.A. Kirkut about the so-called trail of evolution, the missing links. The big point about the missing links is that they are missing. That's the whole reason they're called the missing links. He says, and remember, this is an evolutionist, a non-Christian. He says, it seems at times as if many of our modern writers on evolution have had their views by some sort of revelation. And they base their opinion on the evolution of life from the simplest form to the complex, entirely on the nature, that is, on the theory of specific and intraspecific evolution.